Lord, thank you for the opportunity to meet this morning. We thank you for this beautiful day, this beautiful weather that you've given us, Lord. I just thank you for the book of Hosea. As we're getting close to finishing up, we just thank you for chapter 11, where we see your love and your compassion, your tenderness that you have towards your people, Lord, and we thank you for that. And now we see, as we go into chapter 12, where you are a God of love, but you are also a God of wrath, and punishment will come. So thank you for this text. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Okay, so we are in chapter 12. Looks like we just have, Lord willing, 3 weeks left. Chapter 11, if you remember last week, it dealt with chapter 11, verse 1. It says, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." And we see through this whole chapter 11 this tenderness and this compassion that God has towards his people. And we see at the end of chapter 11 where this restoration is going to take place. God is going to restore his people. God is going to bring his people back. And then we jump into these two verses, which I didn't deal with last week, the chapter 11, verse 12, and 12, verse 1. And they're kind of like, they don't really seem to fit into chapter 11 or fit into chapter 12. And Hosea, as we see different oracles throughout these remaining chapters. We saw 1 through 3 kind of had this flow of this Hosea and Gomer, this marriage, this illustration, and how Gomer was unfaithful, and then Israel and Yahweh, and how Israel's unfaithful to Yahweh. And then we come into chapters 4 through 14, and there's all these different oracles, all these different speeches that take place. And it's hard to tell where some break and where some start. And in these two verses, it's kind of challenging. Where do they belong? So in chapter 11, verse 12, because you got to think about it, we ended with, in verse 11, it says, "They shall come trembling like birds from Egypt and like doves from the land of Assyria, and I will return them to their homes," and declares the Lord. So God is bringing his people back. He's restoring his people. And then we jump into this verse. "Ephraim has surrounded me with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit. But Judah still walks with God and is faithful to the Holy One." So we come back to Ephraim, the 10 northern tribes. This is their character. They're deceitful. They're liars. This is who the house of Israel is. This is their character. And then he jumps into Judah. And we've seen Judah kind of talked about throughout the book of Hosea on and off. If you remember, that we know that Hosea is mainly prophesying to the 10 northern tribes in Israel. But he has addressed Judah a few times, just like he does here. But Judah, contrasting Ephraim, which is the 10 northern tribes, still walks with God and is faithful to the Holy One. And now when we jump into the chapter 12, that's going to seem totally contradicting each other, when you'll see in a second. But they're still faithful. They still walk with God. They're faithful to the Holy One. But Ephraim feeds on the wind and pursues the east wind all day long. They multiply falsehood and violence. They make a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. So Ephraim, thinking about feeding on the wind, biting at the wind, there's nothing. There's no value in that. It's worthless. It's vanity to do this. They pursue the east wind all day long. This is what they do. It's all futile. And then again, their character of who they are. They multiply falsehood and violence. They make a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. And we've seen through multiple chapters in Hosea where the 10 northern tribes do. They went out to Assyria, they went out to Egypt, and they looked to them for security instead of looking to Yahweh. They put all their hope in them instead of Yahweh. But this wasn't going to save Israel. Obviously, Assyria is the one that's going to come in 722, which we're right on the doorstep of this with Hosea. We're right on the doorstep where Assyria is going to come in and take them into captivity. So now we jump into this next section in verse 2, chapter 12, verse 2. It says, "The Lord has an indictment against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. He will repay him according to his deeds. In the womb, he took his brother by the heel, and in his manhood he strove with God. He strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He met God at Bethel, and there God spoke with us. The Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his memorial name. So you, by the help of your God, return, hold fast to love and justice, and wait continually for your God. Okay, so now he's dealing with Judah. He's not dealing with Israel in this section, okay? And he has this indictment against Judah. And if you remember, there's the two sections in Hosea, 1 through 3, 4 through 14. If you flip back to chapter 4, verse 1, we see this indictment against Israel. It says, "Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy or a charge or a lawsuit with the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or steadfast love and no knowledge of God in the land." And then we've dealt with those things all the way through these next chapters. And now Hosea comes and he says kind of the same thing. I have an indictment against who? You now, Judah. This isn't just Israel. This isn't just the 10 northern tribes. I have an indictment against you. And he says, "I will punish Jacob," talking about the two southern tribes, "according to his ways. He will repay him according to his deeds." So we don't know. He doesn't specify what they are. I mean, if you think of Israel, what were the two things in Israel that characterized Israel overall? Does anybody remember? Think of the book of Amos, too. Same time period. What are the two major sins that they had?
Oppression of the poor.
Oppression of the poor. That was the main one that focused on the book of Amos. And we see it. We see it in Hosea, too. But what's the one where we really see in the book of Hosea? Think about the marriage of Gomer and
unfaithfulness.
So we got this idolatry, this worship of Baal, this unfaithfulness that they have. He doesn't name anything for the two southern tribes, but he just says, "You will be punished according to his ways and according to his deeds." And that's how they'll be punished. And so then it goes on, and he says, "In the womb he took." Now we're going to see these three examples that I got to tell you are really challenging. It's like if I was writing this wouldn't be the three examples I used, because they are extremely hard. And maybe it was much easier for them to understand. And there's multiple understandings of why he used these, but this comes down to a plea. Verse 6. So let's read verse 6 for a second. This is what it's leading up to. "So you, by the help of your God, return, hold fast to love and justice, and wait continually for your God." He's pleading with them to return, to repent and return to God. And now you got to think about it. He's using these three examples to help them understand this. And it's not very easy to understand these examples, what's helping us lead to this. But I'm just going to go through basically one commentator's understanding of this, okay, that I think fits these verses as best as possible. But here's the three examples. The first one: in the womb, he took his brother by the heel, okay? So this word is, he took his brother by the heel. He's talking about Jacob and Esau, okay, the twin brothers. In the womb, Esau comes out first. Jacob is holding his heel. This word is grasped. Okay, could have been, this one commentator says, it probably was a broader meaning in the time of Hosea, which probably meant having, or he would supplant or replace or overcome. Okay, that's the thinking, to replace or overcome, prevail, like he's holding his heel and to overcome Esau. Okay, so that's the first example. "And in his manhood, he strove with God." So let me just read what one commentator says about these two things. He says, so relating back to Esau, supplanting Esau, foreshadowing Jacob's latter acts of suppression. Okay, so looking then to the future. So this commentator says, at any rate, trying to understand this passage or this verse, he says, "This unusual event, coupled with Jacob striving with God in his manhood, underscores an aspect of Jacob's character that was important to Hosea's illustration. Jacob was a man who sought to overcome. Jacob was persistent in his goals. Hosea portrays Jacob's character as the same in his later years as it was foreshadowed at his birth. So from his birth to his early manhood, Jacob strove to overcome." That's what he says he's trying to get at in this verse. He sought to overcome. From the time of his birth, all the way then, all the way through his manhood, he strove to overcome. Then we see in verse 4, the next example. He strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. So this in the second example, we see this mysterious encounter with this figure, this mysterious figure at Jabbok. Okay, this, we could read this. It's in Genesis 32, 22, 32, but we're not going to. It's dealing with where Jacob wrestles with God, wrestles with the angel. Everybody's probably familiar a little bit with that understanding. And you could spend a lot of time walking through that passage, but we're just going to get to the main point of that. I'm going to read just three verses out of that. It says, the same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. And so this is Jacob, because at the time he's running from Esau, okay? He's running from Esau. He's left. He's gone to another land. And now Esau is coming, and he's going to probably meet Jacob. Esau and Jacob are going to meet. And he's concerned. He's afraid Esau's going to kill him. So this is what's taking place before this. But right in the middle of this is when he wrestles with the angel. He wrestles with God. So he took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had. And Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, let me go, for the day has broken. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So the point of this, what this commentator says, and with this argument, he says the point is Hosea is trying to make is that Jacob prevailed in his struggle in persistence. Okay, same thing, just like this other example before with Jacob. He's talking about he's grasping his heel. He strove with God. This is Jacob. He's persistent. He prevails. Then we go to the third example. And he says, in middle of verse 4, he says, he met God at Bethel, and there God spoke with him. The Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his memorial name. Okay, so now this is the encounter at Bethel that he has after this time where he wrestles with the angel. Okay? And this is where God changes his name from Jacob to Israel. Okay? So he's saying at this, he met God at Bethel. So what's the point? This is where God changed his name. And you know what God changed his name to? Israel. And what that means is that he strives with God. That's what Israel means. Okay? So if you take these three examples and you try to use them and you go, okay, what's he trying to say when we get down to verse 6? This is a plea to the people. So you, by the help of your God, return, hold fast to love and justice, and wait continually for your God. So Hosea is telling Judah, turn to God. Keep covenant loyalty and continually wait for God. So Jacob has this persistent relationship with Yahweh. He's persistent about having this divine relationship with God. And Hosea here is telling the people, you want this relationship, this same relationship that Jacob has with God, that he enjoys with God, then turn back to him. Wait persistently for God to act, and he will act if they turn to him. So that seems to be, honestly, the best argument, I think, for those verses where he's understanding Jacob, and he's taking Jacob and saying he strives with God, he's persistent, he's doing these things, and he's saying, Israel, you need to do the exact same thing, but by the help of your God, return, hold fast to love and justice, and wait continually, persistently for God. Okay? And then he jumps to this next section. And now he's back to Ephraim, okay? He's moved from Judah, and now he's back to Ephraim. And he says, a merchant in whose hands are false balances. He loves to oppress. Ephraim has said, ah, but I am rich. I have found wealth for myself. In all my labors, they cannot find in me iniquity or sin. I am the Lord your God from the land of Egypt. I will again make you dwell in tents, as in the days of the appointed feast. I spoke to the prophets. It was I who multiplied visions, and through the prophets gave parables. If there is iniquity in Gilgal or Gilead, they shall surely come to nothing. In Gilgal, they sacrifice bulls. Their altars also are like stone heaps on the furrows of the field. Okay, so now we have this analogy of the merchant. Sometimes this word merchant is actually translated Canaan, okay, meaning Canaanite. And so this meaning Canaanite, because the Canaanites, when they thought about a Canaanite, you thought about a merchant or a trader that was dishonest in their business, okay? So this Canaanite, they had this fame reputation of traveling merchants. So that's how they sometimes translate this word. And what's interesting about this word is he uses it a merchant, but he could also be using it as a Canaanite, referring to the 10 northern tribes. He says, in whose hands are false balances and love to oppress? So Israel has taken on this, God's looking at Israel, and he's saying, you are just like the Canaanites. There's no difference between you and them. I look at you, and I see dishonesty. I see false balances. I see how you oppress the poor. I see how you do all these things. And he's looking at them and going, this is you. And I can use this same term for you, and it's right, because this is who you are. And so they've taken on this identity of them. And it's because what? I've quoted this verse many times in Hosea 8, verse 14. He says, it's because they've forgotten their maker. They've forgotten the knowledge of who God is. And they've taken on this character of the Canaanites, which is scary, because God, when they went into so Joshua leads them into the promised land. They go into the land of Canaan. They're supposed to remove the Canaanites. They don't. They intermarry. They lead them into Baal worship, which has taken them down this ugly road. And now you can't even tell the difference between them. Such the importance, and we've talked about this before, but such the importance of who you surround yourself with, who you marry, because those are the people that are going to lead you. You think you're going to stand strong, but those people led them right into idolatry, led them right into this same thinking of oppressing the poor. That's where it led them. They knew they shouldn't oppress the poor. Proverbs 11:1 says, a false balance is an abomination to the Lord. An abomination to the Lord. But a just weight is his delight. They knew this. But they've fallen right into this same thinking as the Canaanites. So this merchant, Israel, this in whose hands are false balances he loves to oppress. So the merchants not only cheated them. We saw in Amos where they used false balances, false weights, but they also oppress. And so they're not just to the point of cheating them. They're actually extorting from them, where they oppress and they actually do things by force. That's how far they've gone down the line. To gain their wealth, they've desired their wealth and lust after their wealth so much that they've gone to the point of not just cheating them, but actually oppressing them to the point of force and taking from them. And that's where they are. And this tells them exactly where they are in verse 8. Ephraim, the 10 northern tribes, has said, ah, but I am rich. I have found wealth for myself. In all my labors, they cannot find in me iniquity or sin. And if you remember, all the way back from Amos, talking about the 8th century, because that's when this was, in the time of Jeroboam II, how they were wealthy. They gained all this land. They were prosperous. But the comparison, they were prosperous in their wealth and their land, accusations and all that they had given back to them, but the moral decay was incredible that was taking place here. And this verse shows it. this moral decay. We saw back in Amos 8:5, it talked about this, how they became so rich and how they oppressed the poor. Let's just look there for a minute, because it's this same kind of understanding of false balances. In chapter 8, verse 5, just in the middle, well, we can start in 5. Says, when will the new moon be over that we may sell grain? They have these feasts that they celebrate to Yahweh. And what do? All they can't wait is for, they just can't wait for them to be over so that they can sell. And the Sabbath, that we may offer wheat for sale, that we may make the ephah small and the shekel great, and deal deceitfully with false balances, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals and sell the chaff of the wheat. This is their character, who they are. They deceive people to gain wealth. And what's scary about this is the point that they are at, they've done this, they know God's law, they know how they should be treating the people, they know they shouldn't have these false balances, they know they shouldn't oppress the poor. But look what happens here. He says, I found wealth for myself in all my labors and all the things they've done. They cannot find in me iniquity or sin. That is a scary place. That is a scary place. Just reminded me when during prayer meeting, Dan was just joking, but you know, nobody was talking about confessing sin, and he said, oh, I'm glad none of you are sinners. But man, if we ever get to that place where that we don't think we have sin, that is a scary place. That is a real problem.
That's a seared conscience.
Totally. Yep, suppress the truth because they love their sin so much they hold it down, and at a point, that seared conscience gets to a point where you don't even see your sin anymore. And that's scary because you come to a place, now you've got a hard heart that you won't turn to God. He says, so in my labors, I cannot find in me iniquity or sin. Now, in Hebrew, this word sin can sometimes take on the idea of punishment along with it, okay? So this could be saying, in all my labors, they cannot find in me iniquity or sin. They may be at the point of going, you know what? We've been doing this so long, because they have been. They've been prosperous and they've been abusing the poor for quite some time, where it actually could be to the place where they're going, God hasn't done anything about it. And it's no big deal. I must not be sinning. Everything is okay. God hasn't given us punishment. That same thing, when you think about 2 Peter 3 in verse 3, what does it talk about? It talks about these scoffers that come, right? They're following their sinful desires. This is what they're doing. They say, everything just keeps going on. Nothing ever seems to change. Judgment isn't coming because God's patient. He's patient towards those elect, I believe. But he says, however, that judgment of the ungodly is going to come. And how's it going to come? It's going to come like a thief in the night. It's going to happen just like that. And all of a sudden that punishment's going to come. And they may be sitting there, they may be thinking that, man, everything's okay. There's no problems here. We're not seeing our sin. We're setting it aside. God hasn't done anything about it. And everything's okay. But this is a scary place to be, because we know even in this situation, eternal judgment, I'm not talking about eternal judgment with the Assyrians, but that judgment's coming. And it's right on the doorstep. Punishment is coming. And they're not seeing their sin. And they have no guilt. They have nothing about what they've done. It's like Dan said, they've seared their conscience to the point that they have no guilt about oppressing the poor. They don't care. All they desire is their lustful gain for wealth. That's all they care about. So then into verse 9, he says, I am the Lord your God from the land of Egypt. I will again make you dwell in tents, as in the days of the appointed feasts. So there's another two examples we use here. He's going back to, I am the Lord your God from the land of Egypt. God is the same God. He's the same God that was back in the land of Egypt that he is now. People want to say, well, it's the New Testament. God is love. No. God is the same. It may look a little different, but God is exactly who he was. And he's saying, I'm the Lord your God from the land of Egypt. And what's he going to do? I'm going to act the same way. I will again make you dwell in tents as in the days of the appointed feasts. This is a puzzling verse. We have this analogy of this dishonest merchant And now he goes in and talks about where God says, you're going to go back to Egypt, or you're going to go back to the time of the appointed feast, and you're going to dwell in tents. He's referring here to the Feast of Booths. So because he's not actually referring all the way back to Egypt in the wilderness, because that was when they were in tents, okay? Then in Leviticus, it talks about these appointed feasts that they celebrate, okay? They're celebrating what took place in Egypt, okay? So in Leviticus, I think it's 23, they talk about these. It's a Feast of Booths. Okay, and it's a celebration. But in the Old Testament, it doesn't really make it clear the significance of the booths. It's like, what is the reason? And there's a couple ways you can think about this, or both at the same time, which I think we're going to get to both in this passage. But it could be talking about remembering their conditions that they had. Okay? Helping them remember. Now here they are celebrating this feast of these conditions that they had, looking back to these poor conditions. Like, now they don't live in tents, okay? Or it could be referring to the significance of this time back in the wilderness when the nation of Israel had this childlike trust in Yahweh, okay? During those wanderings in the wilderness, okay? It could be referring to that, or it could be referring to both. But so Yahweh's referring, or Hosea's referring to this appointed feast. You're going to go back to this time. You're going to dwell in tents. Okay, and we're going to come back to that in a second. And then he uses this example. I spoke to the prophets. It was I who multiplied visions, and through the prophets gave parables. Let me sum up the last part for 1 second, just so you can get that in your head. One commentator sums this up in this way. He says, Hosea says that Israel, talking about the Feast of Booths, he says, Hosea says that Israel, the wealthy merchant, will be reduced to poverty, but we may view this humiliation as a loving act of God by which he will restore their need for dependence on him. Okay, so if we stay in context with this merchant, okay, that is loving their wealth, that's all about their wealth, oppressing the poor, doing all these things, and then he talks about this feast. So he might be saying that, you know what, you have everything wrapped up in your wealth and everything that you have, and he's going to take all that from you and take you back to a reduced place, a place of poverty where you don't have anything. And he's going to take that all from you. But sometimes, also, like he could be using this what this commentator says, humiliation as a loving act of God by which he will restore their need for dependence on him. And so I think it's probably what he's saying. I think it's probably both of these things. He's taking him to a place where he's going to take everything from him. He's going to take him down to nothing, which we see here in verse 11. But he's also going to use this as a loving act to bring them back to him, help them return to him. And because how many times does God do things in our life where he takes us to a point where to the lowest point, and we look back on those lowest points in our life and we go, that's exactly where I needed to be. It's exactly where I needed to be. I thank God he took me to that place because it opened my eyes to see my sin. And we see with the nation of Israel, God is so loving that he's done this time after time after time. We saw in the book of Amos where he brings all these things upon him, locusts and judgment upon fire and all these different things to help to bring them back to him. But Israel is at a point of, they seem to be at a place of no return right now. Their conscience is so seared that there seems to be no return where they are at. But what a loving thing that God is still doing to bring them back. Then we see in verse 10, I spoke to the prophets. It was I who multiplied visions and through the prophet gave parables. And remember, we're still in the context of this merchant, right? This understanding, this deceitful gain, this is Israel. And so here's another loving act of God. I spoke to the prophets, and it was I who multiplied visions, and through the prophets gave parables. God is a gracious God. What does he do? He sends prophets to help point their sin out. We saw this in Amos. Amos 2, he says, no, it's not Amos 2. Yeah, it is. Yeah, in Amos 2, he said, verse 11, he says, and I raised up some of your sons for prophets and some of your young men for Nazarites. Is it not indeed so, O people of Israel? This is this loving act of God that he raises up prophets, somebody that's going to speak for God, help point out their sin. He raises up Nazarites, those who are living a godly and holy life for people to look up to. These are loving acts of God, but they don't listen. We've seen in Amos and Hosea, in Amos where he told the prophet, Amos, go, Israel told him, go away. Go back to Judah. We don't want to listen to you anymore. Because they don't want to hear it. They've suppressed the truth to a point that they want to live in their sin, and they've come to a point where they're losing fully the knowledge of God. They don't even know who God is anymore. And then we see a transition in verse 11. And he says, if there is iniquity in Gilead, they shall surely come to nothing. In Gilgal, they sacrifice bulls. Their altars also are like stone heaps on the furrows of the field. Many translate this if to since. If you look back to verse, think about Gilead right here. If there is iniquity in Gilead, go back to chapter 6, verse 8. It says, Gilead is a city of evildoers tracked with blood. It's pretty apparent how Hosea is seeing Israel, Gilead. God sees them. This is a city tracked with blood. They're evildoers. As robbers lie in wait for a man, so the priests band together. They murder on the way to Shechem. They commit villainy. There is social injustice tied to this. So since there is iniquity in Gilead, they shall surely come to nothing. This is going to take place. So there's these two major sins that I was talking about earlier that Dan brought out. This oppression of the poor, these social injustices, and this Baal worship, this idolatry. We're going to see them represented in these two places, Gilead and Gilgal, which we're going to see in the next verse. So since there's iniquity in Gilead, this oppression, this oppressing the poor so that they can get rich, what's he going to do? He shall come. They shall surely come to nothing. Could be also just referring back to this time that God's going to take them back to dwelling in tents, where they lose everything. They go back to this poverty, but they're going to come to nothing. And then we see in the next clause, it says, in Gilgal they sacrifice bulls. Their altars also are like stone heaps on the furrows of the field. Okay, there isn't anything inherently wrong in the sacrifice of bulls. That isn't what is wrong. But we see in Hosea, it tied to, you go back to Hosea 4, it's tied to Baal worship. They had this syncretistic worship going on that Yahweh was a little bit in this, but ultimately they were worshiping Baal. And they were praising Baal for their prosperity. Their Baal is their fertility god. So he says, in Gilgal represents this. They sacrifice bulls, talking about to Baal. Their altars also are like stone heaps on the furrows of the field. So what's going to take place here is the punishment's going to come because of their Baal worship at Gilgal, what that represents. And their altars are going to turn into stone heaps. So just so you can understand this, he says, their altars also are like stone heaps on the furrows of the field. So think of somebody that's plowed the field And what's taking, you got these furrows, and what's happened is they're plowing the field and rocks are coming up. Okay? Rocks are coming up. What do? They pull these rocks out and they throw them into piles, into these stone heaps. And what happens is then they take them away. These stone heaps are worthless. There's nothing. They're going to be torn down to nothing. And that's what he's saying, this punishment's going to come. All your altars, all the things that you have, it's going to be torn down like stone heaps on the furrows of the field. That's what they're going to look like. And so these two cities, Gilead and Gilgal, are representing the whole 10 northern tribes in their oppression and in their worship, in their idol worship that they have, not worshiping Yahweh. And then to finish this off, in verse 12 through 14, it says, Jacob fled to Aram. Then there Israel served for a wife, and for a wife he guarded sheep. By a prophet, the Lord brought Israel up from Egypt, and by a prophet he was guarded. Ephraim has given bitter provocation, so his Lord will leave his blood guilt on him and will repay him for his disgraceful deeds. Another couple challenging verses. It's like, what is he doing with these examples to help Israel understand? And it's kind of difficult. Like, again, like the ones before, there's many different understandings of this. So Jacob fled to the land of Aram. There Israel served for a wife. So now what Jacob did was he was fleeing from Esau, because Esau was going to kill him. What did he do? He went and then he left, and there he served for his wife, Leah and Rachel. Can't think of who the father was. Who was the father?
Laban.
Yes, thank you. So he served Laban for his wives. And for his wife, he guarded sheep. And I think that one commentator, this is what we're going to go with, this understanding, he's talking about guarded. He guarded the sheep. In some sense, Jacob was protected. He left the land where Esau was going to kill him. He left, and he was protected in this area. And what did he do? He guarded sheep. And then we have this next example. So think of protection. And then we have this next example. By a prophet, the Lord brought Israel up from Egypt, and by a prophet, he was guarded. So this prophet was Moses. Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt. Moses was the prophet that protected them. Moses was the prophet that gave them the law, that helped guard them. However, Ephraim has given bitter provocation, bitter speech, that so his Lord will leave his blood guilt on him and will repay him for his disgraceful deeds. These two examples should be reminders of the love of God, the protection of God, how God's taken care of his people. I mean, how many times do you hear in the minor prophets talking about how I'm the Lord that brought you out of the land of Egypt? And it should have been a reminder and a wake-up call for them, but it wasn't. Just like these examples aren't a wake-up call for them. And because that, so the Lord will leave his blood guilt on him and will repay him for his disgraceful deeds. Punishment's coming. It's going to take place.
It makes me think of, like, in a way for us, from an application standpoint, how why we need to be, you know, God's not reminding us, removing us from Egypt, but us reminding ourselves daily of the gospel, what God saved us from and for, and you know what I mean? Speaking the gospel to ourselves. Yeah.
You're going to hear that in the sermon today.
What's that?
You're going to hear that in the sermon.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, exactly. But that's what the prophets do. I mean, and this is a loving, gracious thing that God sent them the prophets and they ignored it. And so, I guess let's leave with this, that there is prophets that God sends into our life. We're going to see that in Psalm 51 today. But there's people that God brings into our lives and helps us see our sin, helps us see how we're going down a wrong road, helps us see the people that we're hanging around with that's leading us down this road and could be dangerous. Let's not be offended. Let's look and go, man, this is a loving act that somebody's doing for me, helping me out to help me see my sin, and I should listen instead of do what they've done, and they've come to a place where they have a seared conscience to the point of no return. And that's why ultimately punishment is going to happen for Israel. One commentator made a point on, and I must have missed it, or I didn't think about, he was talking about in this verse that I said was confusing. I never really pointed that out. Go back to verse 12 of chapter 11, where he says, but Judah still walks with God and is faithful to the Holy One. But then he turns around in verse 2 of chapter 12, and he says, the Lord has an indictment against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. He will repay him according to his deeds. Seems to be contradictory. Seems to be like, what's the problem here? Well, Israel's to the point of no return. And in this verse up here, Judah still walks with God. Hosea looks and says, man, I see the same illness. This is what a commentator says. He says, I see the same illness in Judah. If you remember, the two southern tribes had like about six good kings. And they helped restore the two southern tribes. They would tear down the high places. And so they're a little bit behind the 10 northern tribes. But they have this same problem. These good kings had to keep coming in and tearing down the high places. And so they have the same potential, I don't know if that's the right word, the same leaning to go into Baal worship. So the illness is there, but they aren't terminal right now like the 10 northern tribes are. They have this illness, but the 10 northern tribes are terminal, and there's basically no return. The punishment's coming. Ultimately, it's going to come with Judah too, and it's a loving act that he's warning them. But at some point, they're not going to listen either. So, all right, thank you guys.